afternoon. Sorry to be late again. I apologize and stampede to beg your forgiveness. We'll open House Committee on Revenue today. This is the 21st, March 21st. Colleagues, we had, as a first item of business, possible bill introduction. We've got several other LCs that are coming forward. Those all, it's my understanding that those have to be at the request of the full committee through the Speaker's office. And so, with your permission, we'll continue to seek authority from the Speaker's office for the LCs that we're requesting come forward from the committee. And with that, we will not have any work session on possible bill introduction today. But I will open a public hearing on HJR 14. Colleagues, you'll notice that this is in reverse. That we had HJR 11 first and 14 second. House Joint Resolution 14 deals with a double majority. And I understand we've got Senator Morse and Representative Hunt. If you gentlemen would like to come forward, please, we would appreciate it. Now, folks, we've got a lot of sign-ins today on HJR 14, I'm anxious that we move through this agenda. However, I will not place time limits on our elected representatives. Thank you. Please. You can talk as long as you want. We leave here at 3 o'clock.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I promise not to mention anything about water fluoridation today. We've heard there plenty about that today. Chair Butler and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. You should have copies of my testimony, and actually you should have a yellow packet that will summarize. It both has a copy of my testimony as well as letters from several other organizations that are not able to be here in support of HGR 14, as well as some editorial columns from around the region. For the record, my name is Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. And I really do appreciate this opportunity to come and testify in support of HJR 14, a constitutional referral that will reform Oregon's double majority requirement, that will allow voters to pass local option and bond measures in any May or any November election, and only in those elections. I think, as I looked at this issue over the last several months and years, it's clear to me that Oregon's double majority election requirement is broken, and we should fix it. In 1996, as you're aware, voters passed ballot measure 47, which included a very small provision that created a double majority voter requirement for local property tax measures. Since then, the double majority rule has placed an unfair burden on Oregon school districts and other local governments who have tried to implement essential local measures. Back then, in 1996, to be fair, there was a problem. Some local governments were placing measures during some of those obscure elections, knowing that many voters would not be even aware of that election. There was abuse of the system at that time, as some local governments tried to pass measures without drawing public attention. Also back then, there were 8 elections held every year during which local governments could place these measures before voters. So every few weeks, as you think about it, every few weeks back then, another election could occur, which limited the abilities to keep track of when the elections were coming. But fortunately, much has changed since 1996. Oregon's vote-by-mail system has been implemented, ensuring that every single registered voter gets a ballot for every single election. By having ballots at their home and having several weeks to actually consider those ballots, every voter has an opportunity to vote, and really no Oregon voter has an excuse for missing an election. In addition, the previous 8 annual election dates were reduced to 6 elections, which were then reduced to 5 elections, which were then reduced to the current 4 elections today. So today, local governments may only submit these kind of measures to their voters during those 4 elections, March, May, September, and November. And they obviously must mail ballots to every one of those registered voters every time. To quote Kevin Mannix, as you'll see in my testimony, quote, "I think we need to revisit the double majority requirement. With vote by mail, there are no more sneak elections, and the double majority is not needed." Some will argue that reforming the double majority will overturn the will of the voters. So I think that's a very legitimate argument. I'd like to present at least 3 reasons why I think that's not a fair argument in this respect. First of all, the original double majority requirement was part of the much larger 47. It was a very small provision hidden within Measure 47. And if you look back at the campaign literature and debate around that campaign, it was not about the double majority. It was about the other elements within Measure 47. Second, you'll probably recall that the legislature sent a measure to voters in 1998, which would have been a full repeal of the double majority provision at that point. That measure was narrowly defeated by a 51-49 margin, but it's important to note that that measure that was referred to voters was a full repeal of the double majority. It would have taken the double majority that had been implemented in 96 and completely eliminated it. The measure before you today in HJR 14 is a reform of that. It does not repeal the double majority. It says that it only applies in the elections that are not May or November of every year. And third, as I described earlier, the addition of vote by mail and the reduction in the number of elections each year has dramatically altered the situation. Since voters approved the double majority in 96, and even since they voted on the full repeal. That's why Senator Morse, Senator Devlin, and I have joined together with 23 other legislators to introduce HJR 14, to allow a simple majority to approve a measure, whether it's a local option or a bond, in any May or any November election. This moderate middle ground approach, we believe, will give power back to voters and reduce the burden on local governments, while still providing the protection of the double majority in all other elections besides May and November. Parents, school board members, mayors, teachers, county commissioners, community college presidents, and public safety personnel across Oregon have told us about their frustrations with the current double majority requirement. Volunteers who have sacrificed family time to advocate for repairing crumbling school buildings, for building new community libraries, or for purchasing new fire or police equipment have clearly made the case that it's time to change this outdated rule. Dozens of school districts, cities, counties, community colleges, and special districts have been unable to implement critical measures despite approval by a majority of voters in their district. And in the last tab of your yellow pamphlet, you will notice a list of the double majority failures. There are three pages listed alphabetically. In every one of those cases, more people voted yes than voted no. And yet in every single one of those cases, the turnout was below 50%. And you can see,
as we look at that list,
you bet,
were there folks that went back in the next general election that were able to pass their budgets?
Absolutely. In fact, one that I'm very familiar with, the Oregon City School District, which went down in May 97, you'll notice that they passed the measure but only got 47% of the vote. They then went back. It was actually the third time out that they were able to pass it. And actually, in that case, they did ultimately meet the double majority. But it took three cycles, three huge efforts by the school district, three time periods of major focus by that community, by the advocates, by the parents, in order to pass that, sucking a huge amount of time away from educating kids. Had the measure passed with a simple majority on the first time.
And did they pass it in a May election, or did they pass it in a November election?
Ultimately, it was passed in a May election.
Okay, thank you.
So I think if you look at this list, one of the most intriguing things is in many of these elections, the measures would have passed even if every single person required to get to the double majority requirement had voted no. So all those non-voters required to get up to the 50% margin, even if every single one of them had voted no, these measures would have still passed. I think the fundamental message I'd like to share is that non-voters should not be able to trump the will of voters. No one should be rewarded in Oregon for not participating in an election. HJR 14 is an opportunity to reaffirm our support for democracy over apathy. We should not continue to reward Oregonians who sit on the sidelines during an election. As the budget process continues to go forward for 2005-2007, HJR is one clear action we can take now that will allow us to assist our schools, police, firefighters, and other local governments without spending a single dime out of the general fund. HJR has earned the support of a large bipartisan group of legislators, local officials, and citizens across Oregon, and I urge this committee to take quick action to fix the broken double majority requirement and to restore democracy in Oregon. Again, thank you so much for your time and the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, colleagues. I would like to acknowledge, number one, gratitude for holding this hearing, because I think it's an important first step, and also to acknowledge the work that Representative Hunt and Senator Devlin have done in taking a leadership position to bring this issue forward. I'm not going to repeat the very excellent work that Representative Hunt has done in preparing testimony but I would like to address this issue from the standpoint of really what is the issue. Is the issue taxation, or is it a fundamental definition of democracy? And that's where I come from on this, is a system that gives greater weight to someone who either doesn't care, is indifferent, or unwilling to open a ballot that is very prominently marked and put 37 cents on it and return it. That is not my sense of democracy. And it's ironic in terms of what we call democracy in Oregon, thinking in terms of the sacrifices and the spilled blood, as Representative Boquist certainly knows, in Iraq, to plant seeds of democracy. Would we ask the Iraqi people to plant the same seeds that we have here in our definition of democracy? I don't think so. Every vote should count. And those that choose not to participate, to give them even greater weight in an election, in self-determination, whether you're a city or a county, just doesn't fundamentally make sense. So I come to encourage the committee to take a favorable action, to refer this to hopefully future action, and let the voters decide as to how they would choose to define democracy. So I thank you very much for this opportunity, and again for the work that's being done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Morris. Questions for our colleagues from the Senate and the House? Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Belizio, please.
Was the decision not to do a full repeal, was that a sort of a pragmatic political decision, or was it a policy decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Belizio, I think to some degree it was some of both. I think it was an affirmation that there has been a problem in the past, but that clearly it's reasonable to expect that every May and every November voters are going to anticipate that an election is coming, be aware of it as they receive voters' pamphlet statements and ballots at their home, and that at least twice a year it's a reasonable compromise. And to be fair, I think a lot of the local governments would prefer a full repeal. This gives them the vast majority of what they need to be able to serve the needs of their districts without going for a full repeal.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank you.
It. Now, we've had a couple of pages of sign-up for testimony in addition to these folks, and the first folks we'll call up the table. I just want to remind you, as you hear this testimony, if you want to say ditto, you're welcome to do that, and that way we'll be able to finish up here today. So the first folks we'll call forward, League of Oregon Cities. Ken, you have a couple of mayors with you, Mayor Olson and Queen.
Thank you very much, Chair Butler, members of the committee. I have two panels. First, the folks from the City of North Plains, followed by officials from the City of Sweet Home. But what I'd like to do is start off with a little overview, if I might. And again, I want to echo the comments of Representative Hunt in thanking the committee for holding this hearing, you, Mr. Chair, for doing that. And I'd like to call your attention to the report that you each have a copy that was conducted by the League of Oregon Cities earlier this year and last year. I will not repeat the good testimony of Representative Hunt or Senator Morse, but make a few additional comments. First of all, the double majority, as we have it in Oregon today, applies only to local government property tax measures, not to any measure passed by the state, not any state tax increase. I would also point out that referral that was the proposed as a complete repeal of the double majority in May 1998 was upheld by a vote of a margin of about 51% to 49%. There were 623,410 votes cast in that election on that issue, less than 50% of the statewide eligible voters. So if that in itself had been a tax measure, it would have been defeated by the double majority. There weren't enough people to vote. Today, there is no such thing as a sneaky election, as you have heard, because they all show up not only in our mailboxes, but they also, on the outside of the envelope, another provision of Measure 47, in red type, say, contains proposed tax increase. So nobody, even if they don't choose to vote, is under the impression that this is not a measure that proposes a tax increase, that it's very clear. Now, we've heard lots of anecdotal stories about the non-voter factor in the double majority. And in September of 2003, the League of Oregon Cities and principally our researcher, Stephanie Nixon, began collecting results from each county for all the local elections held between 1997 and 2003, the years of the double majority being in effect. And that's the report you have in front of you. And one of the fundamental principles of a representative democracy is that citizens participate in the political process. And our report documents that the double majority runs counter to that philosophy and instead gives non-participants equal or greater weight than participating voters. And that fact contradicts one of the most basic principles of democracy in the United States, which is one person, one vote. Today, non-votes have become the determining factor in many local elections. Since 1997, 122 out of the 936 property tax measures failed due to the double majority requirement. But in many of those cases, those who voted overwhelmingly said yes, but voter turnout was less than the 50% required. In fact, of half the measures that failed under the double majority, 61, they would have passed if all the votes needed to get to a 50% turnout had been cast as no. In those cases where measures failed due to the double majority, non-votes were given greater weight than the actual votes in the election. For example, in May 2000, Portland Community College lost a bond measure despite the fact that yes votes exceeded no votes by 33,460. Only 2,207 additional votes, either yes or no, were needed to achieve the double majority. In this election, each of those 2,207 non-votes counted as 15 no votes. Non-voters actually had 15 votes when everybody else had one. Other examples, Deschutes County proposed a police levy in March 2001. The measure received 22,886 yes votes, 7,167 no votes, but only a 44.4% voter turnout. Again, if all the votes necessary to get to 50% had been cast as no, the measure would have passed. Same for City of West Lynn in May 2002, the City of Banks, a law enforcement levy in May 2003, Central Oregon Community College, a bond measure on the ballot in May of 1999. Additionally, the double majority assumes the existence of an accurate, up-to-date voter registration database. While individual county clerks do their best to maintain current records, without computerized statewide voter information, the rolls cannot possibly be kept accurate. And as we have documented, the change of only a handful of registrations can actually determine what is or is not a double majority. The double majority requirement applies only to local government property tax measures, and in order to maintain current levels of service, we're going to the voters more and more often. Oregon's double majority requirement contradicts our fundamental concepts of fairness, equality, and democracy. And the minor change proposed in HJR 14 would at least level the playing field for voters and non-voters in two elections per year. It is a change that Oregonians should be eager to accept. Now I'd like to turn to Mayor Sherry Olson from North Platte.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Chair Butler and the committee for allowing us to come here to testify today. I'm pleased to know that a joint resolution has finally been initiated. I think it's a long time coming, and I am definitely for this initiative and also for all elections. I believe it's an honor and a privilege to vote. And I believe that those who take and carry out this privilege are the ones that want and should be heard, and not the individuals who choose to not go to the mail-in ballot or go to a voting site. In a double majority election, it causes great havoc for any community, as has been stated by the previous speakers. First of all, when there is a double majority election and a person votes no, we don't know if it's from apathy that a person is choosing not because they don't care, they just don't want to come and vote. If they're using their no vote as they're using not voting as a no vote, or to manipulate the double majority situation in that election, the fact that it affects the number of registered voters besides basically being a no vote. We in our community of North Plains want to listen and hear all the voters and what they really want. And it's very difficult to know when you have a double majority to know really what they're trying to say. and it's important to me to know that. And it's a guess every time when it comes back and it fails. The other thing I would like to state is we continue to have difficulties with in a small community with a small number of registered voters when there are ballots that don't get to the people in time. We have people that have passed away and people that move out of the communities, and this continues to be a problem in every community in knowing, you know, getting the ballots to the right people. I do encourage that this bill be passed and also for all elections. And I thank you very much for the time you've given me this afternoon.
Thank you, Mayor Olson.
Thank you. And I'd like to introduce our city manager, Don Otterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just some information.
Restate your name, if you would, please, Don, for the record.
Yeah, Don Otterman, city manager, city of North Plains.
Thank you.
The city of North Plains has been involved in a total of 9 elections since 1997. 7 of those elections were for police services. 3 of the 7 failed due to the double majority requirement. In those 3, the margin of those voting in favor ranged from 53% to 62% in favor. The turnout ranged from 31% to 45.5%. In those 3 situations, in the one that we had the 62% in favor, as Ken had mentioned, if we had the number that we needed to make the double majority all voted no, we would have still passed the measure. Of those 7, as I said, 3 failed due to the double majority requirement. One of those elections did pass, and that was in November of the year 2000. We have also been involved in 2 general obligation bond issues, both of those in the year 2004. Of those elections, one, there was 73% in favor, the other 71% in favor. The voter turnout was 42.7% and 45%. In those instances, if we had made the double majority in both instances with no votes, they still would have passed. And so, to give you an example of the problems that some of the smaller cities face, looking at the small numbers of voters, in the March of this year election, we passed the police levy, except for the double majority. We were 40 votes short of the double majority. The day after the election, somebody walked in the door of City Hall with 3 ballots. They had received them in the mail the night before, so they could not vote because the polls were closed. We don't know how many more times that happens, but in a situation where you have a very small number needed to make up the double majority, and that in that case, almost 10% of the votes needed were not received because the voters did not receive their ballots. And so, you know, there I'm sure are other situations where the double majority is closer than that as far as the number of votes needed. And there may be situations like that, but this is one example that I think works against the city, and especially in a situation where you have, you know, as I say, 73% of the voters voting in favor to tax themselves, but not passing because of the double majority requirement.
Don, how many voters in North Plains?
901.
So even when you get 239 people showing up at an election, you feel like that if that's a May election, that ought to be approved, and a rate increase ought to be approved.
They are the electors that care to vote, and in the democratic process. I mean, if you don't take the time to go out and vote, you shouldn't argue about the results.
Okay. Ken, let's see. We've got some other folks from League of Oregon Cities. Ken?
All right. The city of Sweet Home, if we can bring those up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very
much. I'd be happy to answer any questions after that.
Why don't we get Senator Devlin up here in the meantime, too. Senator, thank you very much. Apologize for overlooking you there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
You looked a lot younger before you started to dye your hair that color.
I know. I know. Some parties dye their hair back brown or black. I think it just looks more distinguished to dye it gray. I have given you a letter that basically outlines my support for this measure in some detail. So I'm not going to actually read to you from the letter, and I'm going to tell you just very emphatically why I'm supportive of this measure and why I'm supportive of a similar measure that Representative Hunt and I have introduced in the Senate. Very clearly, I think that you will see many cities, special districts, school districts, others come before you, counties, with very good documented evidence where they've had overwhelming support for measures but have lacked the 50% turnout rate, in some cases by as few as a handful of votes. If that was the only reason, I would probably say that that was a good enough reason to reexamine this. But even if that reason wasn't there, there is a fundamental flaw in this entire concept, and that's the reason that I will sponsor measures on this, support measures on this, as long as I am in the legislature. That is that we are in a constitutional republic that is a representative democracy that puts a lot of value on participation of the public in the electoral process, where women did not get the right to vote till soon after the beginning of the last century, where many people of color, for all practical purposes, did not have the right to vote until the mid-60s with the Voting Rights Act, where men and women have died to protect that right to vote, both to get self-determination in the first place and to maintain self-determination throughout our more than 200 years of history. And I think it is absolutely reprehensible in this form of government to give more weight to people that choose not to participate than those that participate. I don't care if voters turn down or approve a measure. All I care about is that the people that take the time to take an interest actually vote, and they can determine whatever they want to self-determine, approve the measure, turn down the measure. That is the kind of democracy that I think our, I'm careful here, I can't be entirely PC, but that our forefathers envisioned, and not the type of a democracy where people that don't participate get more weight than those that do participate. I will be here for as long as I am in the legislature saying that this is a bad concept. It goes the very grains of a participatory democracy, and it's one that we should refer back to the voters and at least allow them to examine this issue. And with that, I will close, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator. Questions of the good Senator? Thank you again.
Thank you, sir.
Ken, you had some other folks from the Oregon City sign up.
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I am going back to the Ways and Means process, which I'm sure you know.
I miss it terribly, Senator. Thank you very much. Did you take care of my dental appointment, too? There's some things you enjoy in this.
Chairman Butler, other members of the committee, thank you for having us here to testify today. My name is Tim McQuarrie, and I have served on the Sweet Home City Council for approximately 10 years. I've served two terms as mayor, and over the past 15 years, we witnessed the birth of three measures, which 5, 47, and 50, which brings us to the reason we are here today. Citizenship comes with a price. There is and should be an expectation that people are involved and informed. Through measures 5, 47, and 50, the state of Oregon has created an electorate that is none of the above and apathetic to boot. Measure 5 put a cap on property taxes, $5 per thousand for schools, $10 per thousand for all other entities. Measure 47, later repealed and replaced with Measure 50, gave us the double majority. With taxing districts reaching compression and many more to follow, we are being forced to spend enormous effort and monies to present tax levies several times because of the double majority that do nothing but change the percentages of the distribution of the tax dollars that are available under that cap. Many of the levy votes are passed by a majority of the voters who voted but are negated by those who are registered but didn't vote. All through my formal schooling, I was taught that voting was part of a democracy, a responsibility, and a privilege. In the state of Oregon, we no longer embrace these ideals. We have given the right of decision to those who register to vote but who do not vote.
I do not believe this is the democratic form of government that our forefathers had in mind. In the state of Oregon, we have done some lame things and some good things also, but the double majority is not one of the good things. I would certainly urge the favorable consideration of H.J.R. 14. Thank you.
My name is Pat Gray. I'm the finance director for the city of Sweet Home. I've been the finance director for the last 14 years. I've submitted to you testimony that you should have along with Tim McQuarrie. I was here 3 years ago, March of 2003, speaking before the Senate Rules Committee on this exact same issue. Back then in March, we were trying to pass our library levy, and it failed by 60 votes.
Has it since passed in the general election?
Yes, as you can see in my testimony here, that in March of 2003, out of 3,464 voters in Sweet Home, approximately that much between these four elections, we had 1,672 people vote in March. 54% said yes, but we lost by 60 votes. Again, in May 2003, we went out again to the voters. We had 1,619 people vote. We had a 65% yes on that vote, but we lost because we didn't have 101 to meet the 50%. We closed the library in June. I had no money to run it after July 1st. So we ended up having to close it because I couldn't guarantee funding until we could find out again in September. We went back out to the voters again in September. We had 1,928 voters vote. We had a 72% yes vote on that. So, and we also made the 50% voter turnout by 59%. So it took us closing the library. It took a great deal of work by our action committee, who spent between these three elections personal dollars, $3,640, countless hours and time that these people put in for these elections, to have to keep coming back for three elections to try to get people to vote for a levy in a small community to just keep the library open. That's the only thing that supports our police and our libraries are our property tax dollars. And these are the four-year operating levies that we have to go to the voters every 4 years to pass.
Pat, I'm interested. And excuse me for not knowing, but I need to ask this question.
Sure.
You've gone three times to the voters, and they've said yes, yes, and yes, but without the double majority. Are you telling me that you hadn't gone the prior November?
We did.
You did go the prior November,
then
the regular November?
We went the November 2002 election. There were 12 state measures on that ballot. The voters in Sweet Home received their full text of ballot titles. This came in with the vote-by-mail ballot. They had 12 state elections that went from constitutional amendments to, if you remember, genetically engineering foods. They got the city of Albany. They got the city of Lyons. They got the Jefferson Fire District. They got the Central Lynn Recreational. We had the Sweet Home, the four-year operating levy for the library, and we had the four-year operating for the police department. Now, of course, those are the only two that showed up on the Sweet Home ballot, was the 12 state initiatives and the two Sweet Home, but they looked at it as, okay, do we want a police department or do we want a library? So they passed the police department.
So it passed in the November election?
Yes.
And it was funded?
It's funded.
Okay. But the library didn't?
Did not pass.
So the voters at that time made a choice?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay, that's what I need to make sure.
Sure.
But you knew in advance and presented the budget and presented that when it wasn't required that you have 50-50.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
So just so that I'm aware that it concerns me that we may try and operate any branch of government without knowing for a period of 2 years that we're going to need money beforehand. Then the voters came forward and said, we're making a choice. We'll choose police, but we will not choose library.
Correct. And that's why we took it to the November 2002, because we figured everybody votes in the November election. You can surely try to get it passed.
And you brought it for the next three elections where you failed to get the 50-50.
In fact, we even tried to put it on that special January election to try to hit the next one, because we did not want to close the library, but that was a state-only election. which failed anyway. And then we went every election we could after that to avoid the closure of the library and trying to get it passed. Okay. And it was at the, we went to our political action committee, and it was their decision to say yes. Take it to council. Our library is that important to us. Because
so there are a couple of issues that you're bringing us, so that I can kind of figure this out for myself. One is that in the November election and the even year, when we can do this without the 50-50, there's a lot of issues on the ballot.
Yes.
Okay. Why? And that either confuses folks or, in this case, forces them to make a choice. And when they choose to not support something, and then for the next three elections they choose not to show up, then they've effectively, in effect, the folks that are choosing not to show back up register a no vote.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yes. Yep.
Representative Berger is recognized.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you do understand that under this resolution, you would need the double majority, except in the May and November. You would still have this issue of great big ballots.
Yes. Yes, but hopefully, you know, in the May, it would at least have two options. We'd at least have the May. We'd settle for two. It's better than none of what we're having to work with now, because also in addition to the Sweet Home levies, we also have the Linn County Law Enforcement levy. They're trying to get theirs on the ballot, too, in November. So then we have people deciding, okay, do we want a sheriff's department or do we want a local police department? Why are we voting for both?
And, Representative Berger, that's my concern again, is that what you've got another police department or another public safety issue on the ballot. You get another public safety, and the people say, do we want to spend money for public safety or do we want to spend it for the library? Then maybe they'll choose that. Is there then we come right back to the same situation that we came to in the first place when this was originally passed back in 1996, and that is, we just don't want these various public entities to try and wear us down. I think that was what
that's what exactly what we did last spring. We wore everybody down. Our PAC committee members, let me tell you, we had them. They were the ones that kept coming back, and it was in March. They collected $1,875 in donations. That was for the March election. That's pretty impressive for a community in Sweet Home, you know, with financial constraints. Come the May election, they were only able to collect $305.
Well,
I
guess one of the concerns that I had too, Pat, was the fact that the folks from North Plains, while their case is good, if you've got 901 folks that could vote, and they would like to pass an election with 238 votes or less, that's of concern in this whole process too. Representative Riley, you like senior moments here. Excuse me.
I was going to wait you out.
Representative Galizio, Representative Escobar is going to introduce our guests here before we do that, though.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to introduce our pages of the day, if they'll stand up. They've been here for the whole day, and we welcome them. They're from various parts of the state of Oregon, and we're happy to have you young people here to help us. Thank you.
And they chased off the Boy Scouts, too. Representative Riley, please.
Thank you. I have two questions, if I may.
Please.
First question is, on the November election, where the first one where this failed, what was the percentage turnout on that, if you know?
I do not know that. That was the general election. I do not know the percentage turnout on that. I cannot answer that.
But it was over 50%, I'm assuming.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. Okay. With all these majors, yes.
The other question, if I may, is if we go to November and May non-double majorities, that gives you three more elections in a two-year period. Is that and that, I assume, would mean that you wouldn't try to get into these special elections because now you don't have to wait two full years to do it again. Is that a safe...
No, I'm not going to assume that. If I have a choice of closing my library or leaving it open, I would still go to special elections. I would still, you know, pay for those special elections. The city has to, we have to pay the county to run those elections for us. One of them cost us almost $1,000, as you can see in my notes here. The other one, there was nothing else on the ballot. It cost the city $2,563 for the September election. We were the only thing on the ballot. I would still, to avoid a closure, I would still go out and try to get the 50% voter turnout, to be honest.
Tyler, don't show the September election amongst those that failed from the information that was provided this
No, the September did not fail.
Did not fail.
No.
So the library was reopened.
We reopened the library at the end of September when we knew the voters passed and it was approved by the county.
So you had over 50%?
Yes, 59.24.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Other questions of Pat? And Pat, were you finished? Or?
Well...
Okay.
Well, one thing I do have a concern of. Okay, now we're talking about things in the past. You know that big voter push that they did to get people registered last fall for the presidential campaign? That's going to be a killer.
Sure it is.
Because we now have all these young people who are registered to vote, and as you can see in my testimony, it's going to get harder and harder to get that 50% voter turnout as we take them to the voters, because you only have to be registered to vote. To vote now.
Okay.
You don't have to vote.
Next up, Craig.
Yes, Craig Martin, city manager, City of Sweet Home. Ditto all of the testimony and support that you've heard previously. And just to point out a couple real quick, short, important points for the City of Sweet Home. The library and police levies in Sweet Home are, we call them local option levies. They're not an option to the City of Sweet Home. Because of the implementation of 47 and 50, those levies were not included in our permanent rate. We don't have a choice for other jurisdictions to go out and pass measures to maybe increase services or, you know, build a new facility or something like that. I understand what some of the concerns were when this legislation was put on the books. But in the City of Sweet Home, quite frankly, it's life or death for our police department and our library. And only by virtue of having formed a special district for our fire services, which was our only option, it was life and death for, literally, for our fire and emergency services. So I would just encourage your favorable consideration of this legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you pass a serial levy at that point? Is that what you did for the library?
Yes.
Okay. And is it 5 years? Is that what you did there?
Four.
4 years. Okay. Yep. Other questions for these folks? Thank you very kindly. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're in a serious time crunch. We've heard much of, and there's still one other bill that we've got, much of the information. We've got some folks that have signed up, still nearly a full 2 pages. We're going to ask that you limit your testimony to just a few minutes each. Brian Clem, Salem City Club, Carol Robinson, OBA, Joan Smith, North Clackamas School, please come forward. The next batch of folks that needs to get ready, Joan Edelman, Lon Statenspiel, and Pat Farr.
Lori
Statenspiel.
Pardon me?
Lori Statenspiel.
Yeah, we'll get Lori too.
Well, that's instead of Lon.
Sorry, I can't read her.
Like Lon Chaney.
She'll forgive me. All right, please go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Clem. I'm the president of the Salem City Club. The City Club is a civic organization in Salem with more than 100 members. And what we do is get together every other Friday for lunch and engage in what I consider the very essence of democracy. We have debates featuring both sides of any particular topic, whether it's a ballot measure, candidates, issues. And then we have a studio audience and our luncheon audience who watches and listens and informs themselves about topics. We also have a research function, and we hadn't used it in probably 8 to 10 years. We haven't done any topics where we felt there was something relevant enough for the City Club to try and weigh in with an opinion. We just educate ourselves and listen to debates. But this year, we took this topic on, and adopting some of the League of Oregon City logic and data, we passed a research report and a resolution calling for the repeal of the double majority or at least amending it to something like this suggests by a vote of 50-2. Our organization is very diverse. It's got built into our bylaws processes that balance ideology. So if you've got one conservative, you've got to have a liberal on the committee. And that's
you have over 50% of your members there that day.
Yeah, we did. Just barely. So the bottom line, I guess, is... And just listening to some of these things, it really is sort of enraging that this process is part of our democracy, that we had a ballot measure that dealt with whether people's property tax assessments were too high, and what I consider a huge blight snuck in the back door. And our club feels almost unanimously. Every time I talk about it, we start getting a standing ovation. I mean, it is disgusting. And our voters need a chance to repair it.
Thank you very much. Carol?
Chair Butler, committee, I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on this measure. I'm Carol Robinson from the Oregon Business Association. I'm also here representing myself as a chairperson of the 2000 May bond measure election in Beaverton School District. So I can approach this issue from a couple of different aspects. The Oregon Business Association is made up of 250 large and small businesses across the state. Some of our members include Nike, Standard Insurance, Wells Fargo, Columbia Sportswear, lots of large employers. Our board of directors unanimously feels like this is a very, very destructive piece of legislation that was put in by the voters with Measure 47. We recommend strongly that the Joint Resolution 14 be passed to amend this law to allow additional elections to be used to pass bond measures and local option levies. As a private citizen and a volunteer, I chaired the 2000 May bond measure election in Beaverton School District. It was a $149 million bond measure put before the 150 or so thousand voters in Beaverton School District. We passed that bond measure in that election by a percentage of 63.4% to 38.7%, and 3.5% of the voters determined the election because we did not pass the 50% majority in that election. We could have had all no votes several times over and still passed that bond measure in May 2000. The needs of our community and our school district were ignored until a full year later. The election then passed in November 2000. But because of the May situation, our school district was not allowed to begin the building that was so desperately needed to accommodate growth and the repairs that were needed on older schools because we were more than 6 months delayed in the passage of that bond measure. Clearly not the wishes of our community. From a business perspective, from a personal perspective, I urge you to support this. It also has tremendous impact on individuals in the community. My own family was struggling with the fact that I would again chair this bond measure campaign. My children did not have the advantage of me volunteering in their schools, in their classrooms, helping kids read because I was out chairing another bond measure campaign. The $150,000 that we had to raise to pass this campaign in May of 2000, again, had to go out and ask businesses, ask individuals, and suck up community resources to put something back on the ballot again in November. This does not make sense from a business perspective or an individual perspective, and I urge you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Joan?
Well, my name is Joan Smith, and I am vice chair of the North Clackamas School Board. And I would like to speak today and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for allowing us to speak on this issue once again. I want to put a personal face on the issue, as like Carol did. Since ours was the first election in March 1997 to be impacted by the double majority, it received much statewide attention when voters approved the bond by an overwhelming margin but found their will was overturned or denied when not enough voters sent in their ballots. A post-election survey showed that a full 10% of the voters chose not to send in their ballots because they believed that it would help defeat the proposal. If those people had voted no, the proposal would have passed. For the record, the proposal passed with 13,600 voters, or 58% voting yes, 9,900 voting no. There was a 46% voter turnout. Out of 53,800 registered voters, 24,700 voted. One of our parents active in the campaign filed a court challenge. That happened to be me. Court challenge to the registered voter totals. If successful, the challenge would have had a judge declare that up to 6,000 voters should have been removed from the rolls and allowed the bond measure to pass. The challenge attempted to use a new law passed during the 1997 session to allow a judge to rule and the county clerk to verify registered voters and have them impact on an election retroactively. Hundreds of volunteers went door to door to homes where people had not voted to help the district verify that more than 6,000 registered voters should be challenged. County Clerk John Kaufman cooperated with the district in the verification effort. In the court case, the district attempted to show that more than 4,362 voters from the total of 53,800 registered voters were ineligible to vote because they were either deceased or had left the residence with no intent to return. Evidence gathered through the work of hundreds of volunteers showed that more than 4,700 people had left their homes before Election Day. The schools of our district are deeply grateful to the parents and members, community members, along with staff who worked so hard to gather the evidence for the court, said Superintendent Ron Nace with a dime. Legally speaking, Judge Patrick Gilroy's decision was fair. It became impossible for us to meet a higher standard of evidence, especially when the court said that the district must show that any departed voter had no intent to return. The judge handed down his verdict in March of 1998. The district then sought to pass an identical bond proposal in November 1998, with one exception, that it had to increase by $10 million more dollars because of inflation. Of course, seeking funds for the same 270 projects now required more funding and more voters. The next election produced a 62% landslide with the majority turnout. I would like to thank you today for listening to this testimony, and I'd encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you very much. Question for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. So, Jonah Edelman, Lori, you want to do it for Lonnie? next time you'll print a little better, won't you? And Pat Farr, and then on deck, Kathy Eaton, David Buchanan, and Catherine Firestone.
Chair Butler, for the record, my name is Jonah Edelman. I'm the executive director of Stand for Children, which is a statewide citizen lobby with 1,500 members across the state. And I want to thank you, Chair Butler, for holding a hearing on this important issue. And also want to thank Representative Hunt and Senators Morris and Devlin for their leadership. Ditto the comments that have been made. I don't want to take a lot of the time. But I want to make just a couple of points. Clearly, just from listening, Chair Butler, there's a combination of reasons to move this legislation forward to the floor. The double majority as it now stands is wasteful. We're hearing of time spent away from home by parents who are trying to be civic. We're hearing of resources that could or should be going to charities that are having to continue to be fed into campaigns. There's a fairness question here in terms of the value of a non-voter's vote compared to the value of a person's vote who takes the time to participate in our democracy. And I think it sends the wrong message. Not only is it clearly eroding public services in communities, it's also eroding our culture, our political culture. And I just want one vignette on that. I mean, it means a lot to me. I'm running an organization that is all about getting citizens involved in the political process. My mother was the first African-American woman admitted to the Mississippi Bar. And she spent much of her life in her early adult years trying to enable African-Americans to get the right to vote in the South, to facing her own physical peril. And, you know, it's a principle that she felt strongly in, and I think our country came to recognize through the Baker versus Carr decision and the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act the value of one person, one vote. Which is, you know, basically being mocked by this law that we have here in Oregon. And this is a state with a strong populist tradition, a strong tradition of civic involvement. And it's something that I hope this committee will take proactive steps to right. so that we have the kind of culture that we want in a state where citizens get involved and their participation matters. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonah. Lori?
Chair Butler, the committee. Lori Satinsville, the Oregon Community College Association, Government Relations. I've passed out testimony from two of our colleges, just two of our colleges that have been impacted by the double majority requirement. Preston Williams from Portland Community College and board member Dean Wendell from Rogue Community College. Briefly, and with the time commitment here, as you can see, these levies, they've been passed. They had to go out a couple of times. The May in for Portland Community College, they had 49.6% turnout, 2,000 votes. They were short. And again, with Rogue in May of 2002, 46% turnout. Again, these were passed later on. The additional resources, the scarce resources that the community college has had to put out to pass those, in addition to the time lag from the time they were passed in order to be using them, the inflation cost of construction, have also impacted our colleges. Thank you.
Thank you. Pat, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Butler. Chair Butler, fellow former colleagues and committee, I'm going to do something that I wish more people would do when I was sitting in the chair that Rep. Galizia was in. I'm going to be very short. I spent years on the school board in Eugene. I spent 8 years as a Eugene City Councilor. And so I've been a part of the election process quite a bit. The point that I want to make is that about 22 years ago, I did something that most of the people in this room didn't have to do. I took a test that allowed me to become a United States citizen. And when I took that test, I was promised that my vote would count. With a double majority, I do not have that assurance that my vote will count. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pat. Question for this
just time? One quick question.
Galizia.
Does this affect, doesn't the impact of this effectively violate the Equal Protection Clause? Because you're giving more power, really, to...
As I was listening to the...
Not lawyer, but...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. As I was listening to testimony, I had questions as to the legality of this from the standpoint of one person, one vote, which the Supreme Court has consistently upheld. No one here is proposing this. We don't need to waste a lot of time in the judicial process. You all can right this wrong and let the voters decide whether they want to make this change.
We'll seek to get a legal opinion. Probably
am I the all committee done. Chair of that?
You'll be the committee chair of that. this House Joint Resolution has a subsequent referral, however, to state and federal affairs. So I'm sure at that particular point, it would still have that question whether or not there was some constitutional issues. But I am very anxious, and while I've got folks from the League of Oregon Cities here, and I don't remember seeing anybody from counties, but I'm anxious to know, to have a dialogue in this process. There's Art right there. I'm anxious to have a dialogue at some point in the next few days regarding this as to how far out these various taxing entities are planning. Why is it that we're being caught short on these kinds of things? I can appreciate that we might come up short in a library or those kinds of things, and particularly some of our public safety issues. But I'm very anxious when we've got folks that are coming out and getting defeated in a regular November election and then show up in the subsequent election periods and are continually raising money and being defeated, raising money and being defeated, and then finally getting it passed in the subsequent November election or at a later time. But I would like just a little bit of a history as to how much money is being expended and then the whole budget process locally. I must have, from my earlier budget years at local government, must have forgot how that worked, whether we don't plan for 2 years in advance or something. So other questions of these panel members? Representative Pat, do you have a...
Just one last thing. I forgot to thank you, Representative Butler, for having this hearing. 2 years ago, Representative Hunt and I wrote House Joint Resolution 53, and we had to have our own hearing in private.
No more private hearings, no more passing private bills and laws. Thank you very much. And we have League of Women Voters, Ms. Eaton, and David Buchanan, Catherine Livingston.
Pardon me? I'm sorry. Firestone. That's Firestone, I presume. Ms. Livingston? I'm sorry. I was looking at Bob Livingston previous to that. Bob said he fully agrees. I appreciate his testimony here. We'll read it in the record. Thank you. Please. Ms. Eaton?
Chair Butler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages informed citizens to participate in government. I just have a couple of points I would like to bring out to you. We believe that a healthy democracy requires both the opportunity to vote as well as ensuring that every vote counts. It is essentially undemocratic to nullify a majority vote in favor of fiscal proposal because less than 50% of the registered voters participated. The proposal before you would reform the present double majority, and we believe that this would, in allowing such fiscal elections to be held every year, it will eliminate, for the most part, the other elections that people are feeling are inappropriate. The proposal takes away mainly the ability of non-voters to control the outcome of elections and put citizens in charge of their voting decisions. We feel in the name of democracy and in representative government, this is extremely important. We urge the committee to move H.J. 14 forward to the House and to support it and bring it up for an election that the citizens can decide. Thank you.
David?
Chairman Butler, members of the committee, my name is David Buchanan. I'm the state chair of Oregon Common Cause. Common Cause is an organization that works for election and campaign finance reform. One of the aspects of our election laws that it can be embodied in the phrase one person, one vote. Another concept of our election laws is every vote counts. Currently, another concept embodied in our election laws is not voting can be more powerful than voting. That concept runs counter to all the rest of election law and the concepts behind our democratic process of elections. In tax law, there's a concept that says that if you want to discourage an activity, tax it. If you want to encourage an activity, don't tax it. The same thing occurs with election law. If you want to encourage voting, don't disempower it. If you want to discourage voting, empower not voting. This double majority concept empowers non-voting. It's a concept that works counter to all the other aspects of our democratic elections process. We shouldn't encourage non-voting. The concepts in HGR 14 go part of the way toward eliminating this concept. It doesn't eliminate it totally. I think that it's a good concept to say let's take a step further down this path. Let's look at what the results are. Let's examine some of the turnout figures under these May and November elections and see if maybe we can in the future take a further step to eliminate the concept of rewarding non-voting. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Catherine?
Yes, I'm Catherine Firestone. I'm the Executive Director for the Coalition for Schools. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate your hearing this very important measure today. I have submitted written testimony, so I just want to make a couple of points. This is not a measure about a particular segment of our society. This has affected schools, kids, communities across the state, whether you're talking about general obligation bonds out in Central Oregon's Community College or Rogue Valley, whether you're talking about school districts that stretch the entire Willamette Valley. This has had an awful impact on what happens in our school communities. The standard for those who run local campaigns should not be that they have to gamble on who or how many will show up to an election. Mm-hmm. The standard should be that each side crafts a compelling argument and then the voters make a determination about who indeed won. I would also like to reiterate a comment that Pat made. In the wake of enormously successful voter registration drives this last November election, We should be celebrating an increase in the number of people who want to participate in our democratic and civic rights. Instead, we are faced with the fact that we must weigh whether or not we can meet yet a higher bar in our communities because of the increased numbers. That's not democratic. It's not the way our process should be. Finally, HJR 14 is not about raising taxes. It is indeed about the right and responsibility of voters to take part in their government, in their communities. I appreciate this committee hearing this bill. Clearly, it's a step in the right direction for good governance and good public policy. I urge your continued support so that we can move this discussion forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. Question for any of these members on this panel? Thanks again. We appreciate you being here. And finally, we've got David Williams, Art Schlack. And while you're coming forward, Bob Livingston was kind enough to present us indicating knowing our desire not to duplicate testimony, since I just wanted to add my testimony to many previous speakers, that the Oregon State Firefighters Council supports HJR 14. Thank you for holding the hearing. And in the interest of time, we don't need to testify. However, please know that our organization supports HJR 14. Bob Livingston on behalf of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. Thank you very much, Bob. Mr. Williams?
Hello, that's the greatest testimony ever.
You've got short and to the point.
David Williams, Oregon School Boards Association. You're being handed out now just some data from our website. We have a little election analyzer tool for all school district websites going back to almost all of the elections from 97. I think we're missing a couple from 1997, including that North Clackamas one you heard about earlier. And the sheet that you have is filtered down to all elections whereby the double majority was in effect and they did not receive the required 50% majority vote. This includes some that did not even receive the 50% yes vote. Just to add for note, it could be argued that some of these, for instance, scrolling down about halfway down the page on March of 99, the Coquille election, where they lost that by the double majority and 49.7% of the vote, it could be argued that by some of these campaigns spend a great deal of effort on voter turnout in an effort to overcome the double majority and may have neglected some on the yes turnout as well. So I just print it out for your own edification. And just to echo that, I think the real important message here is not so much about the wins and losses for campaigns, but really is more esoteric about the nature of democracy. Of course, our country was founded on the principle of no taxation without representation. And I think people who would choose not to vote are, in effect, declining that representation and should thereby live by the rules by which the democracy has put forth. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about this data, and feel free to go onto our website. You'll see a website listed at the bottom there. If you want to fiddle around, it's really a great tool to filter and sort and kind of see what's happening around the state.
Thank you very much. Art Schlack, and then we do have Lori Werwin that's signed up. If you want to come forward, Lori.
Mm-hmm.
Art?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Schlack with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I'll be very brief. Our association adds its voice to those that support HJR 14. On March 14th, our legislative committee met and considered this matter and asked that we voice our support. As you know, the Association of Oregon Counties supports the concept of local control, and we believe that the voters of the state of Oregon should have the opportunity to vote to consider whether they want to retain or to amend in the manner of that is presented in HJR 14. So, Mr. Chair, we support it.
Thank you very much. Lori?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the 43,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, several of whom are in the audience today, as it's our lobby day. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having this hearing. I'd like to echo that gratitude from those who spoke before me, and you have my written testimony, so I will very, very briefly just hit the high points. the Oregon Education Association, too, supports returning to the democratic principles of majority rule, and we think that's really the key point here. There are elections we will have lost or won in the past and again in the future. Just a week ago, Pendleton won its local option levy with a double majority turnout in a special election, and we applaud that community for their commitment to their education of their students. So the only sure loser in this really is democracy, as you've heard, if we do not fix this problem. We believe that the whole issue of the double majority is a factotum from another era, an era in which we didn't have full implementation of vote by mail. There was a concern, whether it's valid or not, I'll leave for others to decide, but there was a concern that not everybody would be aware of when an election might be on the ballot that could affect someone's pocketbook. But that's just no longer the case. Everyone gets a ballot. There's no reason in the world that we should have this extra hurdle that, in effect, a non-voter, a non-participator in our system of democracy should have more weight and be able to trump either a yes or a no voter at the polls. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lori. Questions of members of this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your being here and participating. Thank you for your written testimony as well. And thank you, Bob Livingston, for your testimony. Colleagues, again, if and when this bill were to come back to us for a work session, it goes to the state and federal affairs by subsequent referral. So we'll have that as a matter of discussion amongst ourselves as we further consider this. With that, any further discussion at this time on HCR 14? Hearing and seeing none, we will close the public hearing on HCR 14 and open the public hearing on HCR 11. Steve?
Mr. Chair, HCR 11 deals with funding school capital costs. What the resolution does is to revise the state constitution. And by way of information, since this is written as a revision, it requires a two-thirds vote by the legislature to pass it on to the voters. It authorizes general obligation bonds of the state up to 0.5% of the statewide bill market value, and requires that those proceeds be used to match revenue from school district local obligation bonds for capital costs. It prohibits the repayment of those bonds from property taxes, so the state bonds would have to be paid from some other source than property taxes. The capital matching fund is created that the bond money is deposited into, and then it's given as matching grants to school districts for their capital costs. It would redirect state lottery funds when the Education Stability Fund is fully funded. Currently, that 15% of the net lottery revenue goes into a capital matching subaccount. That is eliminated, and a fund replaces that the 15% of lottery funds would go into. So it would go into this same school capital matching account. It defines capital costs as those related to acquisition, construction, improvement, remodeling, maintenance, or repair of pre-K through grade 12 public schools, and it allows the legislature to implement laws to carry out the provisions of the HDR 11, and it would be submitted to the voters at the May 2006 primary election.
Thank you, Steve. Representative Hunt, you're here again. You're about God's business today, aren't you? Taking good care of us. Please come forward, and you'll give us a history of what happened last session, too, I assume.
I'll be happy to. A very appropriate thing to be about God's business during Holy Week, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative Dave Hunt, again from Clackamas County. This HGR 11 comes before you for returning members of the committee, which I realize there are only three of you from last session. This bill will look very familiar because Senator Westlow and I have really taken the great wisdom of Treasurer Edwards and former Chair Shetterly, who introduced this bill last session, and picked up the exact same bill that came out of this committee. You will recall that this bill passed out of this committee with great enthusiasm and made it to the floor where it actually got a majority of votes, but because, as your staffer has indicated, because it requires a supermajority on the floor, it did not pass. The issues on the floor were really completely unrelated to this bill. It was just kind of a strange collision of bizarre circumstances largely originating out of my caucus. And so this is an opportunity to in the interest of cutting to the chase, Mr. Chair, I thought I'd just put that out there. This bill was H.J.R. 18 last session. And as your staff has ably communicated, it really does authorize. It does not appropriate it. It sets up a process so when the money is there, under the current process, as the school improvement fund builds and money will roll over into a capital matching subaccount. Today, as a state, we have no authority to be able to use that money to match K-12. We have the authority as a state to do capital construction for universities. We have the authority as a state to do capital construction for community colleges, and I believe for 14 other things as a state. But we do not have any authority as a state to do any capital construction matching for K-12 schools. So even though we have this school capital matching subaccount today, we have no ability to actually expend the money. So that's why we've taken the exact same bill that this committee passed out and sent to the floor last session and brought it back before you. It really is an opportunity to allow future legislators, as they are able to build up and take those resources as a result of the proceeds from the lottery, to be able to actually expend those resources on the intent on the intended need, which is K-12 schools across Oregon. As we look at this bill, we think it really is good for schools. It helps helps ensure safe and adequate facilities. It also provides schools an option to get lower bond costs as a result of using the state's credit rating through these matching funds. It's good for jobs, construction jobs around our state, which would be good family wage jobs. It really is good for all Oregon. Small districts, large districts, rural districts, urban districts, whether it's new construction or rehabilitation of dilapidated buildings, all will qualify under these resources. It really is one of those things that is not going to make any difference in 2005, 2007, but it will make a critical difference in the long-term future of our state by being able to make this decision now and enable our state to make these plans. So thank you again, Mr. Chair, for having a hearing on this issue. Senator Westland and I and several of you actually who have co-sponsored this bill, appreciate that. And I would urge you to the good work that you or as a committee already did in 2003 to do it again and to give the House an opportunity to redeem ourselves.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Westland, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Westland, District 27, here to testify, obviously, in strong support of House Joint Resolution 11. I can't imagine all the words that Representative Hunt said, but I, in the spirit of not trying to duplicate, I will just say that this, I believe, is an excellent bill. It's an equity bill. It lowers costs for all Oregonians. It helps present a solid, stable, and consistent education system, which, as we all know and I'm sure would agree, benefits all the state. I do believe that in areas where there are low property valuations and communities are dedicated to raising, constructing, and repairing their schools, that does put an extra onerous burden on those low property values where they low property value districts where they do have to have a higher millage rate. This would help offset that at a lower interest rate, thereby providing better education for all Oregonians across the state. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Westland and Representative Hunt, really the primary benefit of House Joint Resolution 11 would be to afford a small school district the opportunity of borrowing at the state rate. Isn't that primarily what we're doing here?
And correct, sir.
And Mr. Chair, in addition to that, as money builds up in the capital construction account, the state would then be in a position to be able to match those resources that local voters would pass through bond measures.
Okay.
Thereby lowering the rate.
Lowering the amount that would have to be
paid from low-value district.
Okay. Questions of either Representative Hunt or Senator Westland? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We have signed up John Marshall and Bob Shiprack.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. The fundamental question, I think, before you in HJR 11 is whether or not you believe the state ought to participate in some way in assisting local school districts with their capital construction and improvement costs. You just heard in your discussion about the double majority, a number of school districts have attempted, some successful, some not successful, in seeking approval of bond measures from their local patrons. And certainly local bond measures will be the most significant source of funding for capital construction or for school district capital construction and improvement needs. But oftentimes, in many communities, either because of primarily because of an inability of local citizens to afford additional property taxes, they have consistently and in some cases overwhelmingly turned down bond measures to assist their local school districts in oftentimes repairing some much needed or making needed repairs to their school facilities. HJR 11 represents what I believe is the first of three steps. One is to amend the Constitution to create the authority for the legislature to ultimately help local school districts with their capital construction improvement needs. The second is to identify some revenue stream to repay that debt. And that could come, as the bill suggests, either with net lottery proceeds going into the school matching account or some other revenue source that the legislature may at some point in the future identify. And the final step is determining an equitable way to distribute the funds. We have 198 school districts. Some in urban areas of the state can't build school facilities fast enough. There are other areas in the state that have declining enrollment yet dilapidated school facilities that need funds to help them modernize and update those facilities. So the challenge, I won't kid you, I think will be significant in terms of how we create equity in terms of distributing those funds, and that will be a challenge that we hope to have the opportunity to engage in. But the first step has to be some form of authorization, and that's, of course, contained in HJR 11, to give the state the authority to use its bonding capacity to raise the funds necessary that at some point could assist all school districts, we believe, with their capital improvement needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Shiprack. I'm Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I came here today to support the measure basically from an economic standpoint. Despite what you may or may not read in the newspapers, the building industry still suffers a high rate of unemployment in certain trades, particularly in the building end of it. So we see this as a jobs bill of some, we don't know how big it is, but obviously a jobs bill that would attract our attention and ask for your support. However, listening to the testimony, I'm also intrigued, as the chair pointed out, that if the legislature has to get the authority to spend money you've already authorized, it makes a lot of sense to me that you'd pass a measure like this. And secondly, if there's any opportunity that you could use the state's bonding authority to get cheaper interest rate bonds, that also makes just a lot of sense. So I'll just stop right there. There's three reasons I could see to vote for this. I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob. Questions of John or Bob? Yes, Representative Hass is recognized.
Thanks. I'm supportive of this as a minor practical matter to help schools, but I know that one of the concerns with this approach is that if it goes to a vote, then a lot of people will think that they fixed schools. And I was just wondering what your read was. Do you share those concerns? Is that a legitimate issue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, it would seem to me that it's easy to distinguish the difference between operating funds, that is paying staff, buying textbooks, and so forth, versus the bricks and mortar aspects of assisting school districts build buildings and repair and maintain the buildings they've got. So I believe it's easy to draw the distinction. In the minds of some voters, obviously, I think Many folks probably believe that approval of the creation 2 years ago of the creation of the Education Stability Fund somehow fixed the problem. And I think for those of us that are concerned about long-term adequacy and stability of K-12 funding, we will have to continue to make the case that this is one piece of it, and it's certainly not the largest piece, which is ongoing operating revenue.
I would agree with that, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I might also add that I was very impressed by the list of sponsors here, including Ringo Starr.
I saw that.
Exactly. McCartney's going to do one. You mean he's not in the building?
I don't know how they didn't get McCartney.
Okay. I guess there's always the perception of the concern that Representative Hass indicated, and that is that folks will think that they've done something for schools statewide whenever we do anything. But I guess, John, I share your perception, that is, voters are going to say it's a bricks and mortar issue as opposed to a school funding. But with that, and Bob, I bring you into this conversation, my angst is that if we have a fund that will assist in this regard, do we have a greater likelihood that local schools will not do the necessary repairs and maintenance issues that they should take care of, and leave this for a larger fund to come in and take care of the problem when it gets really bad? Bob?
My only comment, Bob Shiprack, Building Trades. Mr. Chair, not knowing the size of this, but what I'm hearing from the testimony that was delivered, this isn't going to be enough money to fix all the schools in the state, not even close. I would assume there'd be some kind of a competitive review of the projects, and perhaps I also think there should be some local contribution of some kind as well, in order to prohibit just what you're suggesting, that there might be a school board out there that would put off vitally needed repairs with the hope, perhaps, that they could get some money out of this fund.
Representative Comp?
Thank you. Representative Comp here for the record. Most schools are already in the situation that we have put off vital needs of repair, from restrooms to HAV systems. We're in desperate need of help, and would love to put the jobs business back to work.
Thank you very much. Other questions, this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony here today. Colleagues, we pushed and pushed and pushed to get through 14, so we get through it in a hurry. We got through it in a hurry, and there were only two people signed up for House Joint Resolution 11. However, we do have Kate Richardson, that's here with a letter from the Treasurer's Office. So, Kate, you want to on HJR 11? Now, you can take up the rest of the half hour with me.
I don't think you want me to.
No.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kate Richardson, State Treasurer's Office, and I'm actually the third string here. The State Treasurer was unable to be here, and Ms. Deckard was going to be testifying today, and she's now ill, so you get me, and I will not fill the half hour. The Treasurer has written a letter to you. I think that's being distributed to you on HJR 11. This is a proposal that he has he brought forward actually in the last two legislative sessions, and as Representative Hunt has already testified, for various reasons it got caught in a couple of sets of politics. This time Representative Hunt and the many co-sponsors of this bill are bringing this forward. I just want to reiterate the Treasurer's continuing support for the concept. He has long felt that the issue of schools needs to be a holistic approach, not only on the operational side, but also on the capital side as well. And so this is a proposal that he came up with even before he was treasurer, and is glad to see it being brought forth now. This constitutional amendment would only authorize a program to be developed. It does not create the program itself. That would have to come in enabling legislation in the future, and that's where you come back in designing such a program.
Thank you, Kate. Questions for Kate from the Treasurer's Office? I'm sorry the Navy couldn't join us. Hope she's getting better. Thank you very much. With that, colleagues, we'll close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 11. If there's no further business for the day, we will close the...